In a time where social justice organizations are under attack, we bring you Rad Ops. That stands for Radical Operations. It's a dialogue-based tool that supports organizations assessing and discussing the possibilities and limitations of putting liberatory values into practice.
Many organizations are in turmoil as they pivot to meet this moment. RadOps offers principles, guiding questions, and tools that organizations can use to identify ways that they can and cannot practice liberatory values in this unjust world.
I'm one of your co-hosts, Yeshna Maya Padamsi.
And I'm your other co-host, Sha Grogan Brown. Together, we bring over 40 years of movement operations experience to inform these conversations. Our topic for this episode is resource mobilization, a practice very close to my heart. We're talking about the fundraisers out there, the people who keep the tabs on how to articulate the big picture of the work that's always evolving, who hold the relationships with supporters, and who bring in the funds and other kinds of resources that organizations need in order to operate. Shout out to all you resource mobilizers. We see you and we appreciate you.
Our guest today is Allison Bujalov. Allison is a consulting partner at Dragonfly Partners, co-facilitator at Securing the Roots, and co-host of the podcast Movement Money. Allison has decades of experience bringing folks together around shared goals. She's fueled by a vision of collective liberation and works to carry that into every collaboration she has. In recent years, her sweet spot has been bolstering fundraising and resource mobilization work to build the skills and power needed for communities to resource and fund their own movements. At Dragonfly Partners, she loves helping groups and individuals connect with their fire, rediscover what drives them, and unlock new or renewed paths toward their goals. Toward this end, in 2020, she co-created and co-facilitates Securing the Roots, a fellowship dedicated to resource mobilization and reclamation. Born and raised in Philly, she's also part of the Kalmyk Mongolian diaspora. She runs often, has become an aspiring birder, and loves her family and friends fiercely. My kind of person.
Welcome, Allison. I'm super thrilled to get into this conversation with you today. We've had this conversation a million times offline because we've known each other for a really long time. And one of my earliest memories of you is from being at one of the early Raising Change conferences with Grassroots Institute for Fundraising Training, GIFT, way back in the day. And we've also on this podcast talked about how we can have sort of a like phone a friend people in RadOps work, like folks that we turn to when we're grappling with, you know, how do we get creative in this work and like figure out workarounds or figure out what we can do. And you are at the top of my RMOB phone a friend list. So I'm super excited to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Sha, for saying that. That was, yeah, when I think back on it, that was when I just started thinking about resource mobilizing in a new and different way. So it's exciting to be here and come back full circle.
We're so glad to have you, Allison. And just to get us started, for people listening who might not be familiar with the term resource mobilization, how would you define it?
The way I define it, I think of resources, the first word, and I think of us, our people, being the very best resource, and not in a, you know, capitalist, white supremacist, heteropatriarchal way. Yes, yes, yes. Of course I don't. But what I mean to say is that we really are the reason that we're able to keep pushing with one another, the reason we make choices to either not be in relationship or to continue being in relationship, no matter how complex, dynamic, difficult it can be. It's all us. That's us determining and deciding to do that. We are our best resource. Our ancestors are such a resource to us, and we are hopefully a resource to our kids, their kids, and so on. And so That's what it is. It's really thinking about resources outside of centering, decentering money. Mm-hmm. What happens when we center something else, when we center ourselves, when we center nature. So that's about the resource part. And the mobilization really is, how are we moving those resources? How are we moving them inside of ourselves and for ourselves? How are we doing that in community and in relationship with others? Yeah. So that's my kind of snapshot in my mind when I think of resource mobilization. And then, of course, it translates to moving the money. What do you think it is, Sha?
Yeah. I mean, I think I shorthand moving the money a lot. But I love what you named about relationships, because I really think that does come down to, even when it's about money, it's actually about relationships that move the money into, you know. And I remember when I first started getting excited about resource mobilization or fundraising, even this idea of like, there is more money in some places and there is less money in other places, and we could move it because it's us humans managing these fake numbers on screens. So fictitious capital. But I also learned the framework of resource mobilization during the U.S. Social Forum process in the late 2000s. Shout out Michael Leon Guerrero, who hired me to run the grassroots fundraising for the U.S. Social Forum. You know, and that vehicle that you were really helped, you helped birth into being in this country. It was, you know, a global structure that, you know, then we tested out here in the US. There was a resource mobilization working group that I was brought into and like learned a bunch there. So that's kind of where I draw like my roots of understanding the framework of like, it's more than just money. It is all the resources, the in-kind contributions, the labor that, like you were saying, that we recognize that it takes.
And it spans across time and space.
Yes, totally. Mm-hmm. How about you, Yeshna? When did you come across this term, or what's your relationship to it?
Yeah, I mean, I love what you both are saying, that it's about money and moving the money, but it's also beyond money. And it actually takes me back over 20 years ago at the very first community organization I worked for, the Durham Literacy Center, where we had volunteer tutors teaching adult students how to read and write. And our building couldn't fit all the tutoring pairs, and we needed some outdoor seating. And we posted on our website that we needed some tables and chairs outside. And literally 2, 3, 4 hours later, there were one or two picnic tables outside that someone had just dropped off, because it was neighbors looking out for neighbors, which is also what we're seeing at the time of this recording in Minneapolis and really all across the country. Yeah. And that what you were saying, Allison, it's really about people, and we are each other's best resource. It also makes me think of that story, as well as what y'all are saying, is that we're all resource mobilizers, mm-hmm. and that even if we have a different title, there's always opportunity to move resource to strengthen our organizations and our movements, which is really exciting to me to think about, because I feel like that's another way to break out from the 501c3 system and structure, and thinking about how do we build and collaborate in these different roles.
Yeah, it's almost making me think it's like an umbrella term, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like there's, because it includes money, but it also includes tables that people can loan each other.
That's right.
And, you know, it's an attempt, I think, to frame it this way, to like steer us away from the dependence on philanthropy for organizing.
Yes. And I think there's also an emphasis, too, that we still live in racial mm-hmm. capitalism. Yeah. That is the economy we're in. And so how can we then try and use some of the tools that we have at hand, that we know how to lean back on really, really well, to try and access more power that we can have while trying to navigate these systems and trying to navigate the C3 or C4 structures or whatever new structures we are going to have to navigate in the coming years, the coming months. But yeah, absolutely. So that we aren't feeling like we're so, I think, overpowered by money, mm-hmm. that we can still, you know, navigate it and get it without giving up so much that we know is really critical.
Well, I guess on that note, Allison, I do want to ask you if you have kind of in this like spirit of no one size fits all and sort of zooming out a little bit, we'll have a lot more detailed questions. But if you think about this current political landscape, what's your read on what's going on for resource mobilization? You know, any like big lessons learned or assessments that you're making in this time that you think are kind of fundamental big picture things that you might want to refer back to through the conversation?
I think I want to pick up on something I heard you say, Sha, which is, it does seem as simple as there are a lot of folks who have access to a lot of money or other resources too. And then there's a lot of folks that we're familiar with working with, next to, being led by, leading with, who don't have those resources and who need it, because it could make some kind of fundamental shift for them, to be able to then, you know, do something else, whether it's creating something else or, you know, building and living in different structures, what have you. It is as simple as that. And I know that sometimes or often the most simple thing is the hardest. And that mm-hmm. simple thing is like, connect the money and the people who need it. Not the people who have it or want it, but the people who really need it and could do something that benefits larger amounts of us. That's what I think we could stand to go back to in this moment. And I think the way to access that is through a higher floor for philanthropic institutions, for foundations. And I think that's a simple message that I want to underscore.
I love that. The simplest thing can be the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. And also, it makes sense. Too much money over here. Not enough money over here. Why is that? Why is it so hard? I mean, we know why. It's capitalism plus, plus, plus.
Yeah, I really appreciate that too, especially in this moment where funding is getting cut left and right. We are building a RadOps lineages timeline. And I'm curious, who would you want to name and honor in your own RadOps lineages timeline, or someone that we can add? And in that, can you also share a little bit about yourself and what types of RadOps roles have you played, your own personal operations roots?
Gosh, I think for me, and maybe hope probably I'm not very different than a lot of folks, but my grandmothers were like OGs when it came to operations, mobilizing resources. Both of them, Nadja and Sonia, were just really incredible in mobilizing resources and kind of keeping things moving during really not great conditions for them, either because of something more broadly speaking or something personal to them. So I definitely want to call them into the conversation. Also, I think about some folks who have provided mentorship and leadership and guidance to me. Ella Baker, I feel like probably everyone in the operations lineage, right, thinks about Ella Baker, who made sure that things were running, who taught me. I think that was the first time I learned about in reading, I think it was Barbara Ransby's book, or biography on Ella Baker, but the story of, you know, how money was even being moved during the civil rights movement. Very different than having, you know, a site visit from your program officer and the applications and the character count in the online application system, right?
Say it.
People would do things like, in, you know, the dark of night, drop a bag of cash somewhere
Wow.
You know, in addition to all the other ways of providing rides to folks, providing food for folks. Georgia Gilmore is another, and the Club from Nowhere is another idea, whose, you know, her idea and her work at the time was just so critical to making sure that literally people were safe, people were fed. And then someone who I personally had the gift of getting to know quite well, who did some of those behind the scenes and in front of the crowd work, was Baltasar Pingel, who was my boss at the American Friends Service Committee, and also someone who really impacted me and my life. And I still, you know, to this day do work. Well, I still consider his family my family and vice versa, and then also do work with one of his children. But just knowing how critical the many different parts of our back office, our infrastructure, is for me also a reminder at this, you know, stage of my life, where I think about how I need to be resourcing myself internally in many different ways to continue being able to resource, you know, in the different communities that I move in. Not always the way that I want to, but that's where I come back to, you know, okay, how do I need to resource myself differently so I can show up in the ways that I want?
Thank you for sharing, and thanks for bringing your grandmothers in with us, and Ella Baker, and those amazing examples of how to do things differently. I think we need those right now, reminders of that. Actually, this is at our fingertips, and you don't always have to fill out that long form.
Or if you do, make sure you're hydrated while you do it.
That's right. That's right.
There's, I'm sure, a lot of tips for that.
I really love how you also just talked about, you know, there is like the resourcing of ourselves too. And it's not a side note, actually. That's like a real central question, you know, that we got to also keep ourselves resourced if we're going to keep doing this work.
Yeah. I've been learning something. Can I share this little piece that I was just thinking about recently, that I have a kind of interplay for myself where I'm like, ugh, I feel like such a movement auntie. And I got tired sometimes, and, you know, a little bit like curmudgeon-y. Yeah. And I think those are the moments where I'm like, huh, let me go sit down with my journal. Let me go look in the mirror. Let me, I don't know, like take a walk and see what that's bringing up for me. I don't listen to me and think, oh, damn, she does that work. Well, yeah, no, I don't always do it. I am as human as all of us. But I've been finding those moments where I pause and go, ooh, my discomfort here is telling me something. And it probably is telling me, like, I need to sit with something that's maybe not the most comfortable truth, and think about how this auntie can grow a little bit more. and also honor too the time and the work and everything that has brought me here. Because we are still in it, y'all.
Hopefully we'll, have the resource to keep going.
Yeah.
On all the levels, collective and individual.
Well, I want to ask you this thing we're asking everyone who's coming on here. We shared with you the RadOps principles. And it can be hard to choose, but if you can pick one, maybe two, that like resonate or that have been a guiding force for you in your approach to operations work.
Well, I want to say they're beautiful, your principles. Thanks for having them. It is hard to choose. Only you said two. I think I really like the first one, honoring the dignity of all labor, especially historically invisibilized labor, because right there, let's visibilize it. It made me think of when I was reading through the principles, it made me think of, do y'all know the Liwei Foundation? They're very different than a lot of foundations where they support artists and culture workers, and they really want to emphasize the support for the artist and the culture workers, not necessarily the organizations who are doing that work. There is a way that they support them as well, but it's so few and far between for artists, for culture workers to find support and resources for them and their work. And so this is one of those places. But the piece that I'm thinking of is they have something or just a way of inviting folks in, whether you're an applicant, whether you are on the community grant making panel, which I've been a part of. Everything is really inspired by radical hospitality that I know a lot of or a number of other groups use. But man, it comes through in so many ways. And so I think of it as a beautiful embodied practice at an organization of reproductive justice. And I just want to kind of lift that up. And then, yeah, there's so many beautiful principles. The other one I was thinking of is the cultivating a culture of grounded care with clear boundaries. Personally, I'm still learning how to work with these things called boundaries, right? Maybe y'all have your PhDs in it, but I'm still learning. And I think that when it comes to resource mobilization, I'm able to really think of what are the resources I have, like start within and then move outward, and kind of vice versa, have a more dynamic relationship between like, what are the resources out there? What do I need? What are the resources I have? What are the resources I can give and share? And thinking of my resources not as limitless, but also not as scarce, is something I'm learning. Where's the line between the two? And that for me is a boundary that I'm trying to figure out. Back to, you know, Shah, you and I have talked about this, about just how to care for ourselves so that we can, as you were saying, Yashna, be here for a longer haul, a longer time.
I really love that, because I feel like boundaries are often mistaken as walls, and that what you're saying, it's important to acknowledge that your own resources are limited, but it also doesn't necessarily mean that it's scarce. You can still give. And the point of boundaries is to be able to connect with others. It's not to isolate, it's to be able to connect. And so I think this is a great question in terms of resource sharing, resource mobilizing, is like, what are the limitations, but also what are the openings and where the abundance can flow and the resource can flow. So I appreciate that angle. This kind of leans into the next question, which is, one component of RADOP's approaches is making assessments and decisions about how far can we push against the edges of anything, compliance or funding constraints, in order to run our organizations in liberatory ways. Much of the threat of fascism is based on instilling fear into the mass public as a way to pressure us to comply in advance on our own in order to not face whatever we are being threatened with. So a question for you is, can you think of a time that you've had a vision, or your team has had a vision of doing your work in a values-aligned way, but you came up against a constraint or a barrier or funding restrictions, or have seen other organizations come up against this? And yeah, what did you learn from that?
It's hard not to think about right now, when most of the folks who I am working with at Dragonfly and everyone who we work with through Securing the Roots cohorts, everyone really wants support with resourcing the work. So it's a very weird space to live in for me, because I feel like that interest is abundant and the need is abundant from a lot of the folks in our movement spaces. And yet that offering of resource, that sharing of resource, redistributing, reclaiming, all of that is not meeting that interest and that need for folks to diversify or folks to basically get more money. So I think we're here now, and right now the most visionary thing that I feel like I'm calling myself in to believe, because I'm saying it to others. So I'm like, okay, girl, you got to believe these words. You got to stand on these words that you're sharing with other people and encouraging other people to believe, which is that we're going to do everything we're trying to do to, sure, to resist what's happening and to fight back so we can safeguard what we do have. But also we're going to continue building, because that is what we've done. We wouldn't be here if we hadn't built until now, if we hadn't created until now. And so that's, there's an immense feeling with that. And I think often in these hard times, I find myself leaning toward the, or like not even leaning, but like falling, swooning maybe, but not in that good way, like wavering, I guess, toward feeling like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that we have something else to sort of, you know, navigate around, to try and get past. And I can do that. I can do it. We can do it. I sure as heck am not going to do it by myself. So trying to lean in again to internally, okay, how can I be more vulnerable? What can that help me with? How can I communicate differently or better? So I think that is really the most visionary thing, is to lean into what I can evoke internally. Mm-hmm. Those like slivers of bravery that also I think are like, I just remember saying to my grandfather in like 2009, when there was that economic downturn, like, what do you think about this? You know, what are your thoughts? And he just looked at me and said, I'm just going to keep doing what I always do. This isn't the worst thing that's ever happened in my lifetime. And I was like, right. Okay. That's as simple as that.
Keep going, keep building.
Yeah. You know, for philanthropy, like we are going to keep going and keep building. And now it's really a choice of whether or not, you know, folks who do have more monetary resources that will materially help us right now, if they want to be a part of that and be a part of supporting that.
I'd love to hear from you too, Shah. Any thoughts on this topic?
I mean, so many. How long do we have? But I have been like this question. There's someone, I'm going to keep them anonymous, but that comes to mind when I think about an example that was so inspiring to me about like a choice to not comply in advance. And it was in, I think, 2021 or maybe 2020, when there was a lot of, you know, Trump was talking about attacking funding that was for diversity, equity, inclusion, or DEI. And this person was a ED of a foundation who did a lot of work that could be seen as DEI. And their legal counsel was advising their board and their trustees and the ED to dial back any funding that might be construed as DEI. And this is like a funder that supports racial justice organizing, that supports a lot of really important, powerful work. And she said, no, I'm not going to do that. And here's two reasons. First, this is a threat. It's not actually happening right now. It's a threat, and we're being threatened, but we're not actually directly being attacked yet. So why would we change what we're doing before we're actually even attacked, just because we're afraid of a threat? Especially when it's completely unjust and is against the entire purpose of our mission, you know? And then the second thing that she said was like, okay, so we are actually allowed as a foundation to make gifts to anyone. And what if we actually just drop the reporting requirements, so that it's not a contractual relationship anymore? And so instead of slowing down the funding, what she did was stop requiring reporting on the grants and continued to fund the work and actually funded it more, which was all the more important at that moment of supporting racial justice organizing at a time when DEI is under attack. And I just thought that was so brave and creative, but she didn't even seem like it was brave. She was like, obviously we're not going to do that. And also let's use this to up the ante on what we could be doing anyway. So I just really, I think about that often around the things that we think we're supposed to have to do and mm-hmm. what legal counsel may tell us we need to do. If you just like think it out a little further, you can often find a different way to move.
That's amazing.
And still within the constraints of what, you know, what is quote unquote allowable or legal, if you will, there's so much more that we can do and push, which kind of brings me to my next question for both of y'all, since you've both done this work. What is the role of resource mobilizers in movement building? And what are the edges that we can be pushing around that role?
I'll hop in and say that, you know, this has been, as we've been talking about this, the history of resource mobilization. You know, you can clock the terms back to social forum days, U.S. social forum days, but it starts even before that. But I just remember being in the room when the Revolution Will Not Be Funded at the first 2007, the social forum in Atlanta, where the book was being released, and there was a big talk by a lot of the editors and writers, contributors to that anthology. And people's minds were like being open to the possibility of saying, no, we won't comply. We won't, you know, really rearrange our politics in a particular way for you, for your funds, because that's not the point. The point isn't to get the grants. The point is, you know, to stand in our power and wield it, learn to wield it. And that was kind of the first, I want to say, more widespread story sharing of that, maybe like leftist movement proselytizing, if you will. but that's where we really were able to talk about that. And then we've been seeing that really blossom in these times in particular with, like, I think you were pointing out to it, Yashna, around the mutual aid work that people have been doing. Mm-hmm. Even talking about how folks care in our, you know, smaller little nodes or like little edges of communities. So I think that the spirit of resource mobilization is really what's contributing to a lot of us being able to continue our work during these really hard times where we've been unfortunately experiencing fascism, experiencing oppressive forces in ways that a lot of folks around the world have been. And that's partly what Securing the Roots is about. It's about trying to really say, this isn't rocket science. And I have a friend who calls it rocket surgery, but it's not, it's neither. You know, and we're made to believe that, but similar to sharing the story of In the Revolution Will Not Be Funded, sharing the story you just shared, Sha, too, of like, there are funders who, you know, will do things differently and not comply ahead of time. I think that is the role that resource mobilization can play, and it is doing, I think, right now.
Yeah, no, I think the other thing that's coming to my mind as you're talking is this, the role that development staff or fundraisers in particular, I think, can play is in a moment like this, where we know so many organizations are having to make really hard choices, right? About, you know, either do you shift what you're doing to get the funding? Do you not shift what you're doing and risk losing the funding? Are you losing the funding anyway? You didn't have a choice in the first place. But it means that either we have less resources or we're looking at pivots. And I think there's something about, in all of the operations roles, you know, we've been talking about like bring people in early in the strategizing. And I think that really goes right now also for resource mobilizers who are the ones that really do have to like be able to synthesize and say clearly, here's what we're doing as an organization or as a project. And, you know, that isn't to say like we have to be careful that we're not letting funders lead our strategy. We don't want to do that, but we can. I actually think it's super important to have resource mobilizers in the room when you're talking about what pivots should we even be considering right now, so that both they can be informing what they're seeing from their vantage point and also be ready to immediately explain that to someone who might be moving resources to the organization. So that's like one thing I'm thinking about. I think the other thing I would lift up is the role of organizations like Solidaire and Resource Generation that are organizing people with wealth to be in relationship with movement and not just moving money, which I think is a really powerful thing for anyone to do, to move money to movements, but also there's a role for everyone in our movement. And I think there's something really important about that as well in these times. And with that, there's another thing we've talked about this before, Allison, but, you know, I often say like money makes things funny. and I've also witnessed that, like, you can have really powerful, brilliant organizers who are skilled at entering a room of power holders and making the case for something legislative or calling out a terrible practice across a power divide. But then when you get those same people in a room with a funder or where there's a money power divide, it's like they get timid and collapse. And so I'm just in that, you know, we've seen this over and over. Money makes things funny and has a lot of power. What advice do you offer for how to overcome that feeling in that moment?
Yeah, I think recognizing it is huge. And again, in securing the roots, I've seen it happen time and time again, because we have a number of sessions and there's always a session when we have someone from philanthropy, whether they are individual donors, maybe we have had a lot of folks from institutional, like foundations, institutional giving, but then also we've had folks from like Solidaire, RG, and anyway, these are some powerful leaders in the room, and now we've expanded to have national cohorts. So they're not only, they used to be more locally based in the Philadelphia region, but now it's like nationally too. And so it's across our culture here in the US, maybe the world, where money, we still have money at the center. And so we do come, and leaders are powerful leaders, minimize themselves in a room. And it's really wild, like you said, to kind of sit there and observe. But I think the work of identifying that, of trying to like shift the way that they are thinking about that, even being aware that that happens, is a step toward trying to shift that practice. I think also this happens a lot, whether in trainings or just conversation, where I said recently, you know, people sit in a funder or donor meeting and they might hear no, either, it usually doesn't happen in the meeting. You hear a no over email, or, you know, you get that letter, unfortunately, in your email. But when we're on doors, we're trained not to take no, at least the first time. And so why would we do that when we're working with foundation program officers or when we're working with an individual donor? And again, it comes back to that relational piece. It's a conversation. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity. And that's not to say that one needs to be pushy, but really it's locating, where is our stake in this? Like, where's my stake in this? Where's my community's stake in this? We need money to keep our lights on, quite literally. And if we look at it with the lens of reclamation, it is our money. It is money that was made from the world that we live in, the natural world that we all have access to and is for all of us. It's for itself. It's for all of us. And so, you know, being able to kind of work through all the things that have positioned us and gotten us to this point where we feel like we are not as powerful anymore. How can we enter into and stay in those conversations and relationships where we're saying, no, we're not going to leave until we get the yes? Because that's the power and the stance we bring when we are leading some incredible campaigns that we've won.
I love that. And we can do it.
Yeah, we're doing it. We're doing it.
I really appreciate the hope that y'all have and the, you know, we can do this and keep going, keep building, keep asking, go for the yes. And we're in a particular moment right now. I don't want to bring it down, but the reality is we are in a particular moment of funding contraction for movement organizations. And I firsthand have seen layoffs of a third of the staff at organizations the size of 30 people, organizations the size of 200 people. And I've seen closures and sunsets. So I'm wondering for y'all, what does this moment of funding contraction mean for movement organizations? And how are you seeing people face that? And how do y'all keep turning towards hope even as you're seeing people face that?
I'm like, go ahead, Sha.
I mean, I could go first on this one if you want.
Sure.
Yeah, no, it's real. And it is hard to have hope in moments like that. So I don't want to also sugarcoat, like, we can do it, y'all, because sometimes we actually can't. You know, it's not that simple. And I think the thing that I'm seeing that I'm worried about is, you know, when there, like, a funding contraction requires us to make really hard decisions, like I said before. And the thing that is making me really sad is when that then kicks up internal tensions and exacerbates them and results in just even harder situations, you know? And so the thing that I, like, want and long for and hope for is that, like, we can keep practicing some of this, what we've laid out in these principles around, like, approaching conflict with curiosity, having dialogue with each other, and, like, not letting the decisions of powerful people influence our relationships in that way, like, not giving them that agency, you know? Mm-hmm. And that isn't to say that we don't have things to work out with each other that aren't about them. We do. But we also don't need to let, what can we do? What can each of us do to not let those hardships destroy our relationships with each other? And because I think we're going to need that in this period we've been talking about, like Yeshna named and a lot of other folks have named, like, organizations are closing, mm-hmm. are downsizing, and that's not over. We're still in that moment. But, like, can we keep our relationships through those changes and those pivots? And that's what I want for us. And so that's the thing that I also would come back to hope with is, like, I do think we have the power to control how we relate to each other. And that's something that I would just, you know, ask folks to keep coming back to in all of those really hard moments that are happening right now. And recognizing sometimes it is time to move on for whatever reason. And, like, also let's stay in relationship and with through those kinds of choices that folks are having to make.
You've just summarized two beautiful resources that Dragonfly put together in partnership with Interrupting Criminalization. I'll shout them out. It's In It Together. And then when you can't determine or can't, you know, figure out or decide to be in it together anymore, whether it's an individual in the group, a coalition, a group of groups, then it's a matter of saying, okay, well, you know, we're at a different moment. And so we have another resource when we fall apart. And that's literally, like, how those things came about, because we need to talk about it. We need to face it. We need to engage with those hard emotions and tensions, because those are real.
But thank you for naming those resources. I do think we can put those in the show notes of this episode.
Yes. I think it particularly, like, it's no joke. You're right. People are really looking for those. I myself go to them from time to time for different reasons. And it's often, like, takes me longer than it should to remember that those are resources I could use too. But anyway, I think that's the huge contradiction that we're navigating right now, or a huge contradiction, is that we still do need those resources. You know, all of that downsizing and budget and cutback of funding It's jobs lost. It's people who are directly impacted. And like you said, it has then an impact for the folks who are staying at the organizations or left at the organizations, because the work isn't expected to stop, either by the folks that we, you know, work to support in our communities who still need have those same needs, whether it's for political education or it's for direct services and materials, the needs are still there. And then so are the needs of the folks who are part of our organizations, who maybe are staff members of the organizations. It's very, very real. And we're here because of the funds that have been generated from these really extractive and exploitative systems. So we're in this place, but I do agree. And it's, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about it, but I do think that at the end of the day, we are our best hope for getting us out of this. You know, it's not a small thing to see the three of us here talking about this and then being able to share this with others.
I like how you've talked. I've heard you talk about resourcing as power building, and that feels really hopeful to me. Can you say a little bit about that before we move to the speed round?
Yeah. Power building, I want to say, is kind of like, I'm glad for it, but a little bit of a buzzier kind of word, which is, I still wake up and go, huh, they really picked up on that in philanthropy, power building. Okay, let's go with it. But I think I've been thinking about, okay, well, once we've built power, how do we wield it in a way that is continuing to build our power and not deplete us? And how do we continue using, you know, our critical and creative thinking to navigate this, a moment like this? And so within resource mobilization, I think of that as right now we might not be able to change the no's into yeses, and we still have to move forward. So we are but we're really reaching for the creative tendencies and tools that we have had. Some of us, that means going back to a hustle culture that maybe we were hoping we could leave behind. And now we're like, well, maybe it's not terrible that I can, you know, lean back on that. But I do think it's about tapping into that power and being able to stand in one's power. I know what it feels like for me when I can, you know, get to that space and that place. And boy, I feel like there's a lot more possibility when I'm in that space in my body and mind and in my heart than when I'm not feeling that power. So being able to kind of continue moving the muscle and building the muscle around resourcing our communities and resourcing ourselves, it helps me to recognize and build my power and learn how to get towards wielding it.
Thank you. Yeah. I feel like something I keep hearing in what you shared in today's episode is about both putting philanthropy and folks who can mobilize resources to task, but also what can I do in this moment, whatever role I'm in, whatever position I'm in, how can I resource myself? How can I resource my communities? How can I resource my organization? And that it's points to the relational of, it's a give and take, and we each have to do our part. So thank you for that.
Can I say one more thing, Yashna, on that? Yeah. I think it's about our folks in movement too. The folks who aren't in philanthropy, the folks who aren't the ones with the monetary wealth or access to it, who we have to do work to be open to receiving not only the money, but also the people and the stories and, you know, to be able to work powerfully with Solidaire partners, with our resource generation partners, because, I mean, at the end of the day, trying to find out like what is in all of this work for all of us. Mm-hmm. What is it? What yeah. are our shared interests and needs?
Be open to receiving. It's not just about giving. I love that. Thank you. Unfortunately, we have to close out our conversation and move. But the fun part is we get to move to the RadOp speed round. Hey. Sha, yay. Sha and I are going to ask you questions. And first thought, best thought, your answers. All right. Spreadsheets or Post-its?
Ooh, preference-wise, Post-its. But I use both.
Notes, digital or analog?
I guess functionally digital, but I still make the analog because then I can put, like, I'm a pen person. I like lots of pens and colors and all that.
Love it. Text or phone call or voice notes?
Depends on the person.
That's real.
Receipts. Do you keep them or toss them?
I keep them. Am I just going to come out as a hoarder at the end of this?
Pens and receipts. All relatable. Shout out an org or an ops person you are loving right now.
Oh, well, in addition to you both, I have some like old school lovies, ride or dies. I love the way my beloved friend Kimberly Kwong Charles thinks about operations work, and she's charting her own like newer relationship to it these days. I also love how Roxanne Lawson is charting her own different kind of relationship with infrastructure and like organization and its role. I will like follow Aarti Kasturirangan wherever her deep thoughts want to take me. But yeah, individuals is who I can think of.
Love some of those people myself. What song do you put on to set the tone for a meeting or a session?
Ooh, good question. I can't think of the artist, but it's a good time to fight the system.
So good.
Yeah.
You know that song?
I do. I love it. I almost started singing and then I remembered I can't sing. What is the soundtrack for your operations work? And that could be music or not music.
Honestly, I put on those on YouTube. I'll just be like healing sounds and whatever's like, you know, vibration, megahertz, blah, blah. Like, yeah, I listen to that because that's, I don't know. That's what gets me going, guys.
I love it.
Love it.
Get in the zone.
Binaural, whatever.
All right. What are three words to describe the future of movement operations?
Oh, it's on the come up. Yeah.
Love it.
And one wish you have for movement operations people in this moment?
That you don't forget yourselves. And you live dialectically in that relationship. Myself, my people, myself, and so on.
Thank you so much, yeah. Allison.
Thank you both.
Thanks for being here. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can subscribe and listen to more episodes wherever you find podcasts. Check out the additional resources from each episode in the show notes and take it all back to dialogue with your teams about building adaptable and values-aligned infrastructure. You'll also find links there to subscribe to the RadOp Substack, where you'll get the latest updates and resources.
This show is produced by Josh Elstro and published by Convergence Magazine. Design support from Kimmy David. Music by Tiger Cat, my amazing 10-year-old, with Polish by Josh. And remember,
keep it rad, y'all.